Piero. Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Align the lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I am your host, Nick Toro Jr. For today's episode, I have a great conversation with a photographer who's dealing with literally life and death situations. He's not a photojournalist on the front lines of a combat zone. He actually photographs in what's known as the operational theater, more commonly known as an operating room in a hospital. His name is Tony Chirinos. Tony is based in Miami, Florida. He has a long-term project, which now appears in book form, and it's called The Precipice. And as I said, the majority of the subject matter takes place in operating rooms and hospitals, but he's also supplemented this focal point with a section of photos that deal with surgical tools and then photographs in a morgue. And so Tony's work encompasses the span of life and death, illness and health, where we are now and where we may be heading, metaphorically speaking. In any event, I was really fascinated by Tony's work when I first saw it, and we actually connected and thought it would be a great idea to have him as a guest for the podcast. So that's where we're going on today's episode. For the most part, the conversation doesn't get too squeamish or sensitive, but just a heads up if you are sensitive to discussions of hospitals or death, this might be triggering for you. Otherwise, let's jump into my conversation with photographer Tony Chirinos. Thanks for joining me today. Well, hey, welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Tony Chirinos.
How you doing? I'm so honored to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'm flattered to hear that. Tony, you did reach out to me. You shared your work with me, and I was immediately taken by it, specifically because I don't know if it's my personality being drawn to sort of these life and death subject matters. I don't know if that's something intrinsic to photography. You know, maybe we could talk about that as well. But there was just very straightforward, graphic, but not gratuitous nature of your work. I just found really interesting, and hence this conversation today. So I'm excited to dive in and talk with you.
That's great. Let's do it.
Yeah. So Tony, why don't you start by just give me a little bit of your origin story or personal history and how you ended up on this path to photography.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm an immigrant. I was born in Venezuela from Cuban parents who were kicked out of Cuba, and they landed in Venezuela. And then we got here to the United States in 1971. And yeah, we lived in Hialeah, which is roughly where everybody in Miami, Cubans, live, and or where they start. My dad hated it, and we moved to the south in a place called Homestead, which is very rural, a lot of farms. And high school is really the place where I got started. I had an amazing teacher, Susan McGuire, who I dedicated my first monograph, The Precipice, to. And she was just lovely, and, you know, she just sparked that desire. I always wanted to be a writer, and for some reason, I suck at writing. And I found out really quickly that I was able to do something with the camera that I couldn't do with words. And I was able to express myself in a much more clear way using the camera. And I just got bit by the photography bug, and I've been doing it ever since.
And so you said that was in high school age?
Yeah, 10th grade.
So you're probably around my age. So you were learning film and you were in the dark room, I'm sure.
That's correct.
So talk to me a little bit about, I do want to get to, you know, the body of work, The Precipice and related things that you're doing. It seems like it's from a subject matter standpoint, how did you arrive at this subject matter? I'm sure it wasn't, like you said something offline, and I'd like to maybe kind of pick at that a little bit. Is that you're maybe like drawn to a particular darkness, or like, was that always the case even when you were first learning photography? Tell me a little bit about that sort of journey creatively.
No, that wasn't the case. You know, I mean, I think that when I started photography, I think just like everybody else, my high school teacher introduced photography through books, and obviously seeing Walker Evans and Robert Frank and Lee Freelander and all those people, you know, that was my desire, is that I wanted to be a documentary style photographer. And I really enjoy that. And the whole sequencing and visual narrative is something that I strive to do very well. So I finished high school, and my art teacher said, hey, you know, there's this community college that are giving scholarships, full scholarship. And obviously coming from a poor family, you know, that was something that was very attractive. Mm-hmm. I applied and I got the full scholarship. However, I really wasn't prepared for higher education. And so on my second semester, I lost my scholarship. And I didn't want my parents to know, because otherwise I would be a failure, you know, complete failure. So I started looking for summer jobs in the newspaper, the Miami Herald, our local newspaper. And I found this really interesting job assisting a medical photographer for the summer, June, July, and August. And I said, okay, well, maybe I can do that. Of course, being young, you know, you get to do things that, you know, when you're old, you get afraid to doing it. So it said 3 years experience needed. Well, I didn't have any medical photography experience, but I knew how to use the camera. And so I called. They asked me, do you have experience? I said, yes. And I went to the interview with a portfolio of nothing, you know, medically related. However, you know, Dr. Donald Altman saw that I was a go-getter and I wanted the job, and he gave it to me. And he said, okay, so you're going to be working with this medical photographer. And I said, okay, cool. So then, you know, I got really excited because I was going to make money and then pay for my own school. My parents would never know. And lo and behold, at the end of my second month, July, at the end of July, Dr. Altman came to me, and I thought I was going to lose the job. He said, oh, I got to talk to you in the office. I'm like, oh, you know. So he said, this is very important. The medical photographer just quit, and I'm wondering if you want the job. So, you know, here I go from, you know, nothing to being a medical photographer and getting, you know, insurance and vacation and a good pay.
Yeah.
And so I took it and I just started learning. There was this organization called the Biological Photography Association. I reached out to them and they really helped me out. And I started learning about the field, and I had to take anatomy and physiology, so I'd know, you know, what to photograph whenever the doctor said, you know, take a picture of a pancreas. I knew where the hell the pancreas was, and I wasn't photographing the heart, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to educate myself in that way. Photographically, I didn't have to educate myself because I was documenting things, you know? It was just very clear, flash, you know, you name it. And obviously, I was using slides, you know, ektachrome and Kodachrome. Yeah, and so that's how I got stuck into this. And it was very, you know, exciting. I continued to go to school, but now I was a full-time photographer going to school part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents were okay with it. And, you know, they never found out. My dad passed away without finding out that
I was going to ask you if you ever came clean.
I did come clean last year. After I got the book, I started lecturing Uh-huh. And so I lectured at the Miami Leica store here. And my mom went to that. And my lecture had to do with this. And that's when she found out. She found out in 2022 that I lost my scholarship.
What was her reaction?
Well, she came to me after the lecture and she said, you know, you were responsible enough to do it your way. And I'm very proud of you.
All right. Good.
Yeah.
Good. That's good. That's a good ending of that story. So you were fairly young when you first jumped into this. And it seems to me, as we were again discussing earlier, the requirements for this kind of photography that you were doing as a job was very, yes, it's documentary, but like you're explaining that the medical component of it, knowing the anatomy and physiology, as you described, seems to me to, in some ways, run counter to some of those like influences or the books that you mentioned, or the photographers like Walker Evans or Robert Frank or Friedlander. Yet at a certain point, your two different sort of lanes seem to have merged. What do you account for that? And I know that you mentioned, graduate school. When did those two lanes overlap? So it became, because I look at your work and there's clearly all of those things that we, you know, were mentioned. But to me, it seems like this is an artistic endeavor. And clearly, if you're doing a book and, but also, mm-hmm. I know you've exhibited, but the aesthetic of the project is an artistic pursuit to me. So how did this all come together?
Yeah. So while I was working and making images for doctors and nurses and administrators, I found out that obviously this space is something that the lame person doesn't get access to. And then I found out that there were other people. I mean, it goes back to Leonardo da Vinci, you know, and all these people, Eakins, and all these people that were, you know, painting and documenting the whole concept. And so I got very fascinated by that. And so I was working as a medical photographer, but I was still going to school, and I was going to school as an art school. And so art history, whenever I took my first art history class, you know, I found out that, you know, these artists were painting bodies, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I got very, very excited about that. And so that's the direction that I decided to go and say, okay, so I could make art out of the subject matter that I'm photographing on a daily basis. But what can I do to make it like, make it my own? It's not just documenting and making it, you know, just there, but what can I do to make it my own? And so I've been very fascinated with the history of photography, very fascinated with the history of painting. You know, Caravaggio is one of my favorite painters. So, you know, obviously those influences have, I guess, subconsciously embedded in my practice. And then I started seeing things like the surgical theater, which used to be called the surgical theater. Now it's called the operating room. Mm-hmm. Is very much theater-like. You know, you have, right, you know, very dramatic light, and you have actors and props and all these things. And you have, you know, happiness and sadness. And so I try to transform that into pictures. And that's what I did when I started working as a medical photographer.
Yeah.
And obviously was very excited about black and white, because that's just what I like. And, you know, I like processing my own film, and I like printing my own film. So I stuck to black and white. I think color would have been a little too noisy and too in your face. And so I ran away from that aspect.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point, because, and you bring up that description of the theater, mm-hmm. a stage, right? And props and actors and the lighting. And it makes perfect sense from the standpoint of you're maneuvering through this production in a way honoring that performance mm-hmm. aspect of it. at the same time, it's real life. It's life and death. It's flesh and blood, literally. And then you're mentioning also the fact that, like, settling on black and white, I think just one could argue that, you know, black and white brings a certain, like, artistic sort of layer to subject matter in general. But, you know, the appearance of blood represented in, let's say, black and white versus a color photograph, it's just the viewer's going to react to that very differently, I think. So that makes sense to me that black and white would be a more maybe suitable way to treat the subject matter. Although I do see that you have color work of the tools against colored backgrounds, which is interesting to me because I look at those photographs and I think of there are, like, you know, like historic photographs that are studies of tools and forms and I see those in black and white. It's interesting. You shifted to color for those specific ones. And I'm curious, why was that decision made?
The color was more of a play of really what I wanted to do at the end. So I'm very much a photographer that thinks sculpturally. Mm-hmm. So I think that I'm a sculptor photographer. So, you know, I always try to create this three-dimensional rendering in my photograph. And I use a lot of flash, on-camera flash with, you know, hand-built flash brackets and flashes all over so that I can create that lighting dimension. So I thought of buying surgical tools because I thought of them really beautifully sculpturally, and I thought of buying them and just putting them in shadow boxes and just, you know, have them hang
the actual tools on display.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I thought they were so beautiful that I didn't have to do anything to it. I just grab it, put it in a shadow box, and there it is. Mm. But even the used surgical tools were so expensive that I couldn't afford them. Hmm. So I said, I think I can photograph them and make them look real.
Yeah.
And so I started learning about dent glass, anti-reflection glass. I started, like, playing with, okay, how do I make them float in the air? So I started learning about, you know, I can cast the shadow off the viewfinder. And so I elevate the tool from the color paper. And then I started playing with all that, and it ended up to be really yummy, juicy, and, like, you know, like candy to the eye. So I wanted to make something happy or something fun rather than something so dark and so, you know, poetic.
Right. As a foil, I guess, maybe to the other photographs of the surgery or the actual medical procedures. I find it really interesting that, well, first of all, I'm not surprised that these tools were crazy expensive and that was prohibitive to actually just displaying them. But I think in the context of this entire body of work, let's just how you describe, like, bringing color or some kind of levity or like this candy colored backgrounds, yet I can't not look at those tools and make the leap that of what they're actually being used for in a surgical way or anatomical, you know, precision or whatever it is. So that's a clever sort of juxtaposition that you're doing with those, because it's, I don't want this to sound too heavy-handed, but like they're like instruments of death or instruments of incision or infliction. It's, you're elevating them to these sculptural studies, but they're still, you know, it's intense. It's not a floral arrangement against the color background. Yeah. So that's an interesting sort of juxtaposition, especially for a viewer to maybe contemplate that. And having not seen this work in person, imagining how you might present an exhibit when you show the work, has it been both the color work and the black and white work together? Yes. It's always sort of like connected, right?
Yeah. All the three chapters. Yeah. And just to mention something about the tools, these tools can save your life, but they can also kill you. So, true. You know, they have that duality of beauty and harm and, you know, saves your life. I mean, it's, you know, all those things were the things that were going through my head when I was actually seeing the tools and surgery being used.
Right.
You know? But well, then when also, I took them out of the context.
Yeah. But then also even the photographs of, you know, like the doctors at work or like the, mm-hmm. the details of the surgery, one could make that same interpretation that mm-hmm. this is, you know, and looking at them as still photographs, are they saving that person's life? Is, you know, like why, like what is the cause of this surgery? Was it violence? Was it, mm-hmm. you know, just a disease? Mm-hmm. Is it corrective surgery? So all of those things, it's an interesting sort of play between those two sort of poles of, you know, the same subject. I do want to ask you a little bit about the photographs of the doctors at work, the surgical sort of the mm-hmm. black and white work. One of the things that struck me, especially the use of flash in that environment, or is it use of flash or are they the medical lights that are actually used for the doctors to work? Are you combining or like what's the lighting situation like?
So I think that there are overhead lamps that were used. And some photographs, and yes, there were off the camera flash was also used. So it all depended on the image that I wanted to get, and so I used both. Unlike the morgue series, that was a completely different flash setup.
Mm-hmm.
But for surgery, it was a combination of using sometimes the ambient light and sometimes just adding flash or sometimes just a flash.
I don't like to verge into like technical sort of approach of work necessarily or gear, yeah. But in this particular situation, if someone's performing surgery and they have bright lights, but then you're adding flash, was there ever any issue of sort of like the flash disturbing or distracting, or did that ever arise? Any conversations around that?
No, it never did. I mean, I was using flash as a medical photographer, so it didn't seem like it was going to affect it whenever I used the black and white camera. So that was, and the interesting thing is that there was such a mutual respect between the surgeons and the doctors and myself that I and sometimes would dictate for them to do things so that I can get the picture.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they sometimes I would say, can we turn off the light, the room light? And then, you know, you have like this overhead lamp and it looks like, chiaroscuro and a Rembrandt lighting type, mm-hmm. you know, and so yeah, those things happen. So it was nice that they believed in me and respected me and what I wanted to do. And obviously I respected them because they did what they needed to do. So
like just to circle back to something you said earlier, the idea of this, like you're describing painterly light, you know, mm-hmm. you're referencing painters, Rembrandt, you mentioned Caravaggio. There it has been clearly an artistic fascination with the human body, which extends to, you know, the internal organs, muscles. And I know like numerous artists not only either referred to cadavers or mm-hmm. you know, worked with, you know, bodies in that regard. And there is a famous painting, and I think it's Rembrandt, and it's like there's actually an operation going on and there's, you know, doctors surrounding it. So mm-hmm. I mean, like you're sort of tapping into this lineage from a, you know, like from an artistic standpoint. However, photographic versus drawing or painting, I mean, where you're documenting real people, real life in real time. What's the audience reaction when they, I mean, it's like I said at the onset, it's never gratuitous. It's not, and it doesn't feel ever exploitative or anything like that. But I'm curious right. to hear sort of what kind of range of reaction do you get from audience who are viewing the work?
Well, I think that the biggest problem that we all have as viewers that we look at things is that our perception tends to wash out things without having subjectively looking at it. you know, objectively looking at them. So when somebody's, you know, says, oh, you know, are you going to go see Tony's show? It's about death. And oh, no, you know, it's like, so they already have in their mind, you know, their mindset, what the pictures are going to look like. And then when they go and they look at it, you know, they come back and say, wow, this is really beautiful. I mean, thank you so much for allowing me to look through the space that you, you know, you experienced. So, you know, I've had people, you know, not want to see them, and people want to see them, and some eagerness about them. I think that because of COVID and because of what we were seeing on TV on an everyday basis, I think people are more subjective to actually looking at this work than before. And I think people want to see what was happening in those rooms that they would see on TV.
Sure.
And, you know, and in the body bags and that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, I mean, I know that my work is not going to be for everybody. And I know that there's going to be people that are going to have a hard time looking at it. But I think that as artists, you know, we have to, you know, we have to shake sometimes the room a little bit and have people, you know, excited about something, you know, or, you know, just change their mind and see something different that they haven't seen before. So I don't know. I mean, I tend to go and always work in that aspect, you know, that I'm always trying to show people something that maybe they've never been able to see.
On that note. So, I did want to ask you just from the timeline, obviously you've been doing this kind of work for a long time, but the specific body of work and you mentioned COVID, and I'm just curious as far as the timeline, did COVID either push your work? Like you said, there, I think from an audience standpoint or just like a, you know, like as a society, COVID like forced us to consider these things maybe that a lot of people, certainly American culture, would prefer to ignore. You were clearly focusing on those topics and subjects before COVID. What was your experience before and through COVID, and how did it affect your work?
Yeah, so before COVID, I had zero success, nothing. Nobody ever wanted to see this work. And I can tell you that the oldest photograph in my book is from 1995. So that tells you, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but it was something that I had to do. It's something that internally I had to make this work. Then after COVID, it got success. I mean, you know, luckily my book publisher, Nomic, took the risk of making this. And then after that, I had a couple of shows, a couple of solo exhibitions, Miami, New York. And it's, you know, people understand it a little bit more, or at least they're interested in trying to know more about what this is all about, what this space is about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm not the only one that have done this photographically. You know, Max Aguilera, Helwig, photographed in surgery. I mean, he did it in color. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of people that have dabbled into it, but I don't know, you know, completely immerse themselves into this. So
yeah, in some ways it's a testament to your vision and your dedication to your, you know, this your art and this pursuit of this subject matter that, you know, albeit it was due to a horrible pandemic, but it's like the world came around to you a little bit, as opposed to you weren't pandering to or taking advantage of, you know, like, oh, here's an opportunity for me to like get in and stake my claim. I think it's a testament to the fortitude of, you know, your vision. You mentioned Walker Evans and Lee Friedlander specifically. And I do see there's in the black and white work, I do see correlations with some of Lee Friedlander's work. And there was a body of work that I think it was Chippewa. It might've been the name of the body of work where he documented workers. And in some ways it's the approach is very similar. I think about other artists who use the human body in a unexpected way. And Joel Peter Witkin jumped into my head. Mm-hmm. Very, very different, obviously, approach from what you're doing. But there seems to be a sort of a polarizing reaction clearly to his work. And I would argue that his work is veers so much further away from, like, your work has a dignity to it, honoring the process, the people doing the work, the patients themselves.
Thank you. I think that's one thing that I always strive to, you know, as a medical photographer, I had to follow the HIPAA law.
Right.
And I think that that's something that, you know, I mean, for instance, you don't see anybody's identity in any of the pictures in the book, mm-hmm. you know, because I knew how to obscure that, you know, faces, tattoos, birthmarks. And so I got very good at that. So thank you that you saw that in the work, because that's something that definitely I strive to do.
Without recognizable identities, you didn't have to do any model releases or any.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Did you ever meet anybody who's in the pictures?
No.
They wouldn't know, right?
They wouldn't know.
Yeah. And they wouldn't see something recognizable. They wouldn't have any idea. That's it. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Let's talk a little bit about, so the morgue photos, what was your mindset to, like, I mean, I could make assumptions as to why including that sort mm-hmm. of as a component of this, but tell me about how you arrived as to that subject as part of the larger.
So the interesting thing is that each of these three bodies of work, I always thought of them as separate. And I actually reached out to a lot of book publishers showing the work separately. And I got rejected all the time. No, we don't want that. So then I went to graduate school. I retired as a medical photographer. I did it for 16 years. And I really didn't know what graduate school was, but I was, for some reason, I got very interested in teaching. And then I found out that in order to teach in you know, university and college, you need a master's degree. So I went to graduate school so that I can teach. I really didn't go to graduate school to become an artist. I went there to get a master's degree so I can teach. And so I applied to all the East Coast, to some of the East Coast photography program, because I was married at that time. And my wife at that time said, you know, it's better if you do an East Coast, because then I can go visit you on the weekends and it's, you know, easy flight. If it was West Coast, then it would be awful. So I got accepted to a couple of schools and decided to go to Columbia University. You know, I've been to New York a couple of times before I went to graduate school. You know, I thought it was, you know, a great city. And so I went, I got accepted, and I went there from 2001 to 2003. But my first day of graduate school was September 11th. And I it's just like, okay, so does this thing follow me, or do I follow right. death? You know, I don't know what it was, but obviously it was something that it was impactful, but it wasn't my 9/11, because I came from Miami. Mm-hmm. And so my 9/11 was Hurricane Andrew, which devastated the South.
Right.
So, you know, so then I understood their loss, but it didn't hit me as much as it hit, you know, New Yorkers.
Yeah.
So I went in thinking, because I had this experience in the medical field, and I brought with me a bunch of letters of reference from the president of the, you know, the hospital to, you know, a bunch of other people working in the hospital. And I said, okay, well, if I go to Columbia Presbyterian, which is the hospital, the teaching hospital,
right,
I'm sure I'm going to be able to go in and do a project, a medical photography project that deals with art or that kind of stuff. Well, I got rejected. They told me, no, we don't want you here. We don't want any artists close to the hospital. So I got really depressed. I was depressed for like 2-3 weeks. And I said, okay, what the hell do I do? And luckily, I remember that one, a neurosurgeon that I worked with at the Miami hospital was working at Mount Sinai. And so I reached out to him, called him up, and he was very generous. And he got me a meeting with the chief of pathology at Mount Sinai. And I went and I did my spiel. I told him exactly what I wanted to do. And he gave me access. He gave me 24 an hour, 7 days a week,
wow,
access to the morgue. But it was during September 11th, you know, it was during after that time. And so imagine going up to a Jewish hospital with a bag full of equipment that looks like the Unabomber. I mean, I had batteries and flashes and cables, and, you know, these poor security guards didn't know what to do with
it. Sure. Yeah.
And so I had him, you know, the director of pathology had to write a letter saying, you know, Tony Chirinos is a graduate, you know, student, and he's going to come and photograph in the morgue. And so, you know, they started to know me, and I was able to get access. So I would photograph every Monday and Wednesdays at the hospital. And then Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, I would develop and print and that kind of stuff. So
a few things popping into my head. So access to the morgue, how much was it sort of straight documentation of the environment? I know earlier you mentioned in the surgical theater kind of approach where you had leeway to sort of get the picture that you wanted. Were there people there that were helping you? I mean, without,
yes.
I mean, it's morbid, yes, but like I'm imagining that if there's a corpse or a body bag, I saw one of a body bag hanging. Were you directing to a certain extent, or you were just kind of, this is what this environment is like?
It was so new to me that, first of all, I didn't know really what I wanted the project to do. I just wanted to photograph in the morgue, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then when I went in for the first time and I saw these bodies wrapped in white sheet, I said, oh, that's it. That's where I'm going. My connection growing up as a Catholic,
yes,
and having all these, you know, symbolism that is right in your face. And if you don't know that it's in your face and you don't know how to photograph them, then you're never going to, you know, make that connection. So, you know, like the gurney with just the sheet and there's no body. So, you know, that's like the resurrection of Christ. I mean, it was all there for me to grab. And so I grabbed it, and that's the direction that I took it. And then there was people that helped me out a little bit. I didn't ask for too much help because it really didn't need any help. It was all there to take.
Yeah. I was raised Catholic. So all of those things that you were just touching on is something that I definitely can relate to. And maybe in some ways, subconsciously informs even coming to this kind of work originally somehow that, you know, I think that there's something about, you know, you go to church on Sunday morning and there's a wounded body crucified in front of you, mm-hmm, that I think somehow, you know, cannot not affect you subconsciously, or the fact that then many years later, as you described, I mean, like this sort of, you know, this sheet or this covered shroud, there's just so many direct connections there. So, and you were still shooting film at this time, you said, because you were
still shooting film.
And are you now currently, or like,
Yeah. One of the things that I did in the morgue series is that I got really good at photographing stainless steel, and it's so hard to photograph stainless steel because there's so much reflection. So I started like making ghost image of the body. So I would photograph the scene, but then the body is somewhere else in away from the viewfinder, but there's a reflection of it on some of the images, you know. So sort of like the ghost image, or, you know, the body that doesn't exist physically but exists, you know, as a ghost form. So, you know, all those things were things that you know, you work out in your photographic project, you know, and you start getting to see them, and then you start making better ones, and yeah, so it was fun. It was lots of fun.
It's fun shooting in the morgue.
I get it though
from a photograph, like just from the, like being in the sort of the focus, no pun intended, but like actually in the act of like, okay, I'm in this environment. It's got these very unique components to it. I'll be, you know, whether it's lighting or just the, you know, the surfaces. And I would also imagine, like, you know, this is again from a technical standpoint, like dealing with contrast of like shadows or the sheets being white and, you know, all of that. It's maybe a fun challenge or a fun place to be, not mentioning that it's, you know, like a morgue of a hospital. So, but you were reacting. It's like, it, to me, it almost seems like you got to a certain point where you landed on like, oh, this makes sense in the larger sort of thought process of the other things that you were doing. And that this was, in some ways, it's, you reach that logical next step. And then there is an energy, there's a flow to that where you're like, oh, this is this. Now I'm like in this zone where I'm working and you're figuring things out. So I get that sort of excitement component to it.
It wasn't like that all the time at the beginning. The pictures really weren't working. It was more about the things in the morgue and not about, you know, this connection to religion and connection to end of life. And so what happened was that I had a discussion with my graduate professor about that. I felt like these pictures were not really shocking the viewer in a way, or bringing them into this religion connection that I was trying to make. And he says, you know, you should go make pictures without a camera. Go to the morgue and try to make pictures without the camera. And so that day was really interesting because the morgue attending was a very professional person, you know, dressed with a tie. And he wasn't a doctor, but he just attended the morgue and took care of, you know, the family coming in and looking at the body. I mean, he was super professional. And I asked him, you know, I wonder if you can do me a favor. And he goes, what? I wonder if you can allow me to lay in one of the beds inside the morgue and close the door on me. And he goes, yeah, okay. He thought I was crazy. He goes, sure. So obviously the morgue is, you know, these things are refrigerated. You know, they're down to 40 degrees to preserve the tissue. And, you know, so there's no pillows or anything like that on these stainless steel beds that, you know, they slide in and out of the morgue of the refrigerated area. So I laid down on one and he pushed me in and locked the door. And obviously there's no handle on the inside. The dead doesn't need to open the door from the inside. So there I am laying down and a lot of things happen. Just so that what I thought was 30 minutes was only like 7 minutes. And in those 7 minutes, you know, a lot of things happened. I understood. I got connected to death again because working as a medical photographer for 15 years, I was disconnected. I was really disconnected, you know. And so that little bit of time, I got connected again. I heard voices. I felt my face being touched. And I just absorbed it. And I said, this is what I need. I need to understand that, you know, there could be something else, but maybe this is the end. And, you know, it was cold, it was smelly, and it was noisy. Maybe it was my head that was noisy, but I needed to do that. And so I kicked on the inside of the door and he opened it up and let me out. And then after that, all the photographs started working.
Wow. Man, that's really like putting yourself into the project. I couldn't imagine a deeper way. And so to truly understand or give yourself that insight. So like when you were lying there and all of those experiences and thoughts and sound, sensory experiences, and it was dark.
Yeah, completely. And the only light that you would see is when your eyelids, you know, your eyelids would open up and down, and then you would see these colors and shapes and stuff like that. Yeah.
Wow. I don't know if I would, I maybe would last 10 seconds in that, but.
Yeah, I thought I was in there for 30 minutes. I mean, I really thought I was in there for a long time because I went through this whole mental state of like thinking about all this stuff. And then I thought about my grandfather dying and I thought of him being in a space like this. And, you know, he was very important in my life. And so I needed to do it, you know, and I wanted to stay in there as long as I could and experience it as much as I can.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, to your credit, you know, I mean, that shows me like the depth of commitment to this project, or just not just to this project, but to your artistic vision that I think, you know, like really putting yourself into that situation gave you the insight, as you described, that opened up, then the pictures started making sense. And that's an admirable step for you to have taken. And I think it does ultimately, it informs the work.
I can't speak for every other photographer out there, but the way that I work is that I commit and submit to what I'm doing. And that's just the way I work. I mean, I want to inform myself as much as I can in order to be able to express myself in such a way. I'm not going to photograph something that I don't know.
Right.
And that's where Walker Evans comes in to me, is that, you know, it's that concept of knowing what you're photographing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think ultimately the work will show that, if you're not part of that, and just really fascinating, your whole project, and something I think that obviously, post COVID is something that, you know, obviously it's more front of mind with people, but maybe some of us, you know, Catholic kids who grew up were just sort of like, you know, does make a lot of sense to me. Anyway, so Tony, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. I think just hearing that sort of journey and where we landed was just really insightful, and I appreciate the conversation. So thank you.
I'm more grateful to you than you could ever imagine.
All right. Well, thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much.
So there you go, folks. My conversation with photographer Tony Chirinos. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I was really thrilled that Tony reached out to me and we got a chance to talk about this body of work here on the podcast. Just really amazing access to a world where many of us never get to see what happens in an operating room or in a morgue. So I would encourage you to get your hands on a copy of Tony's book, The Precipice. It really is a beautiful package. The printing, the binding is really beautiful. The way that the work is sectioned out, the paper choice, everything about it is just, it really is a great way to engage with this body of work. So I'll share a link for that. I'll also share links to Tony's work online, where you could find him. And also, while I'm thinking about it, I encourage you to find Right Eye Dominant Podcast on Instagram. I usually share additional images from my guests or topics there as well. And if you could, why don't you go and leave a rating or a review wherever you find your podcasts? I would greatly appreciate that. And if you have any questions or comments, you could always go to righteyedominantpodcast.com. Scroll way down to the bottom and you could find a place where you could send me messages and leave me feedback. Love to hear from listeners. So that's going to do it for today's episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Comet Project and Yazar.